and welcome to Between the Margins on CHRW 94.9 FM. And a happy Valentine's Day to everybody out there. I'm Michelle Boyce, and I've got Deb here in the studio, and Adam's on the board, and I have a wonderful young lady on the phone from Middlesex London Health Unit. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
You know, I forgot my piece of paper, and I don't even want to attempt to pronounce your name.
That's okay. It's Shea Dinsa, Manager of Sexual Health at the Middlesex London Health Unit.
Thanks, Shea, for coming in. I really appreciate that. Today's show, folks, we're doing a show on sex work. And for my son out there who didn't know what I meant when I said sex work, that's prostitution and living off of the avails of sex. So today we're going to talk about sex work and the oldest profession in the industry that we have. It's a profession. It's the oldest profession, yet it's not accepted therein as the profession. So we're going to be dealing with that topic today, and Shea's going to help us from the Middlesex London Health Unit, and we've got Chantel from Maggie's coming on in a little bit. And just to get us started off, we've got Emily, who is a researcher. And she does work within the sex work industry, and she's going to lay down the groundwork for us here.
So what makes it really complicated is that there's three different levels of regulations for what workers can and can't do. The two most significant for sex workers are the federal and the municipal. So under the federal criminal code, and so this is the regulation that is currently being challenged, right? And so the appeal is now being set for the middle of June. So we'll find out at the Ontario level if the appeal is successful or not at some point, probably in July or whenever they end up having a ruling on it. So from the federal criminal code, which then affects sex workers across the whole country, so Ontario as well, you cannot, there's four different sections. Essentially, they lay out the framework of what you can and can't do. So it is totally legal to be a sex worker, to be a prostitute. You can put it on your taxes. In fact, you're supposed to put it on your taxes. You're supposed to pay taxes for your employment. You're supposed to do all of that kind of stuff. What is illegal is all of the main activities that surround the actual act of prostitution. So, for example, you cannot get a drive. You cannot refer somebody, and you cannot direct somebody to a place that is used for sexual purposes. So you can get charged just for driving somebody to a work site where they're going to then be participating in some kind of prostitution or sex work. You cannot be found in, you cannot keep, and you cannot be basically in any place that is used more than once for engaging in prostitution. So this is considered a body house. So a sex worker that works from their own apartment cannot see a client there more than one time, because as soon as it happens more than once, it's considered a body house. This includes if you go to a client's house, it includes any location. So a hotel, any place like this that you can go to more than one occasion, that's considered illegal. You cannot live with or share expenses with a sex worker or somebody who is a prostitute, because then you're considered procuring, which is otherwise known as pimping. It says in the criminal code, and this is a quote, anybody who is habitually in the company of a prostitute is considered guilty of an offense. Unless they prove themselves otherwise. There's a reverse onus that's put onto the procuring section, which means that if you're habitually in the company of, say, your best friend or your partner who is a prostitute, then you can be automatically considered a pimp unless you prove yourself otherwise. So very bizarre for Canadian law, where we have this mandate where everybody's innocent until proven guilty. We see that in certain instances that's not the case. In fact, in this case, it's guilty until you prove yourself innocent. And then the last area that of the criminal code that has significant effects on sex workers is the communication laws. And this is the area where the vast majority of charges against sex workers end up getting laid. So it's last recorded count is somewhere between 90 and 95% of all prostitution-related offenses from criminal code convictions are under this particular section, the communication section. And what it stipulates is that sex workers are not allowed to offer to buy or sell. So it's not just sex workers, it's also clients who can't offer to buy or sell sex in a public place or any place that's open to public view. So this could be on the street, it could be in a hotel lobby, it could be in a restaurant, it could be any place that the public is freely able to enter into. So these are sort of the main, very, very quick snapshot of what it is criminalized and what kind of activities are criminalized for sex workers. So you can see how it makes it really difficult to work safely, right? So the communication laws push you out of the streets, right? Because you're anything, any kind of communication on the, in the street-based area will result in charges. But at the same time, you can't work inside because the body house infractions mean that you're not allowed to work, I mean, in an indoor location. So the body houses actually carry with them much stiffer and more significant penalties, whereas the communication charges are often much lesser penalties. So when sex workers are looking at, well, what do I end up compromising my, you know, my legal security, my privacy, or just my physical security, then it can be a very complicated situation. So people are pushed out of the streets and they're pushed out of their residences. So there's not really any place to legally work. But you can totally be a prostitute and you're supposed to put this on your taxes and still make claims for the money that you make in the industry.
Okay, Shay, are you still there?
Yep, I am.
Hi, so what do you think about that? That it's legal to put this on your income tax and it's a legal profession, but you get charged if you do or you don't.
Yeah, I guess it's kind of a rock and a hard spot. I do feel that it is difficult, and I also, along that line, was there a stigma attached because it is criminalized, it is illegal, so I do feel that people are kind of, this is a source of income, this is a profession that some people have chosen for various reasons, so I think it's... I think it can be very difficult for them. They're making a choice to work in a kind of an illegal profession, but at the same time, it's where can they offer their services, or how can they actually work? So they work under these conditions of trying to make some income, but then there's all these rules that they try to stay in, but eventually they may be jailed for their profession.
Okay, and I heard you say that they make a choice to do this. Do you think they have a choice to do this?
I think some people do have a choice. I think there's a lot of stigmatism. I think there's a lot of ideas out there that that people don't have a choice. There are some that they don't have a choice, and there are some that do. And the ones that do, I mean, there is some information out there. The fact that people like this aspect of work because they can control their clientele. They can pick and choose their clients. They can offer their services at a time that is most convenient for them. They may have children. Those children are in school, so they can offer services during that time. Sometimes they may have their, as people term it, pimp, right? And the role of that pimp may be, again, to protect them, find clients for them, offer control of what clients. Those are some of the, I guess, positives. And there's also, in regards to just general healthy sexuality, is that having sex has been found to be positive, that there's endorphins are released and make us feel good.
So tell us a little bit about... the myths around prostitution and about HIV and stuff like that.
Is this for Shaya?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I think, I mean, in regards to HIV, I think there is the myth that people who, they get HIV because they're involved in prostitution. I mean, HIV is out there, and it can impact anybody, and anybody can contract it. Yes, it is contracted through, sexual activity. I mean, it is contracted through injection drug use as well. So I think there's a myth that obviously the more you have sex, the more likely you are to contract HIV if you have a positive encounter with someone who may not notify you they have HIV or you use protection. But, I mean, on the other hand, here at the clinic, we do there are sex trade workers, escorts. There are people that do come in. They do get tested on a regular basis. So they may or may not have chosen to be in this profession, but they do take care of themselves. And that's partially what our role here at the clinic is, to encourage people to get tested. And they may be in a line of work that people agree or disagree, but our role here is to ensure that they are protecting themselves when they are involved in this activity, and as well protecting the people that they do become sexually active with.
Do you have a large clientele here in London that you work with?
We don't. Well, when they come to the clinic, we don't usually ask people's profession. They may disclose that, so it can. You know, we may or may not always know how many clients are coming that are involved in this profession. But there are one of the roles in the health unit in the clinic is we do have staff that do work in the Elgin Middlesex Detention Center, and so we offer services to all women in the jail that qualify according to, you know, their standards in the jail based on behavior, whatever reason. We do offer sessions in regards to safer sex, anatomy, safe injection, drug use, body images, those type of things. So we do have contact with clientele in the jail that happen to be working in that profession.
And do you also offer this for the ones that aren't in jail through the health unit?
We don't currently. What we try and do is we're making the connection in jail because that's the easiest way for us to directly reach some of that population. I mean, we are reaching other women as well. Our focus, you know, we spend a lot of focus on women, but hoping that when they do leave jail, they will come to the clinic and continue to make that connection with us or meet our needs. But our key focus there is just to educate them on their choices and about their bodies and how they could, you know, maybe change a little part of their lifestyle. You know, if they are using injection drugs, that they do get clean needles. If they are having unprotected sex, where can they come? So those are kind of, that's our focus. But it's their choice when they're out in the community if they want to make contact with us.
And where can these women go for the needle exchange and stuff like that you were just mentioning?
There's two locations. There's one at the AIDS Committee of London. They have a needle exchange on King Street, and we're at 50 King Street. So we're actually both on the same street, but we also have needle exchange from 9 until 7 at night on Monday to Thursday. And you just come and you can either dispose of dirty needles. If you don't have dirty needles, we can give you clean needles and other supplies.
And what was the second place you were saying?
It's called the AIDS Committee of London.
Oh, and I thought that London Inner Community Health Center did this also.
Yeah, you can probably get some items from them as well as you can get tested there as well. You can get tested here at the clinic, you can get tested at your doctor's office, or you can get tested at the Inner Community Health Center.
Okay. And is that the Options Clinic at the...
Yes.
Okay. Do you know very much about that?
I know about the Option Clinic that they offer point of care testing.
Okay.
So what that means is that you don't actually have to have your blood drawn. It's just like a little finger prick, and they can you can find out if you're HIV positive or negative. So some people prefer that method because they want an answer quicker. Versus here at the clinic, we do blood work, it can take up, you know, 1 to 2 weeks depending on the lab. And anyone from the Options Clinic who does have a positive test result is encouraged to get blood work to confirm, to confirm again as well. But they're both effective methods. It's just a choice if a client, whatever choice they prefer.
So is there a law? Can you tell us if there's a law that if they do have HIV, what happens? Do they have to report it, and who do they have to report it to?
If somebody happens to have HIV, we just find out through if people get tested anywhere within, and they live within this area, and they have a positive test, we do receive that positive blood work, and usually we just try and make contact with clients to provide support services. That's our key role, is providing support services, getting them connected with the right physicians if they need, because usually they need to monitor their CD4, their count, and because you may or may not need medication. And just being involved in social work as well, because getting diagnosed with HIV could be fairly upsetting. We also, again, we do offer counseling in regards to that. If you do have HIV, to notify all your partners before participating in sexual activity and to use protection.
Okay. And so the counseling that you offer, is that certain days of the week?
No. If you're positive, we try and make contact with you, and we try and work out a time to come in. But people who want testing or that, we always encourage them. It's a walk-in clinic. You don't need a health card. You can come Monday evening between 5 and 7, Wednesday evening 5 and 7, and then a Friday morning between 8:30 and 11:30. And you just walk in, and no appointment necessary, no health card. And you always see a nurse before you see the physician. And if you do decide to have HIV blood work, we will counsel you before what it entails, and then if it does come back, your test result does come back positive, you would meet with a nurse again.
That's great. Well, Shana, we've got a little clip here, a segment that we use in the show called This Is Me, and it's someone talking about their life. We'll be right back after this clip.
Me.
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 This is what it's like
to be me.
To be me.
This is what it's like to be me.
I am
am fairly normal. I'm a grandmother. I have done sex work all my life. You know, I'm not a street prostitute. I have chosen to do my sex work indoors in private, and I've chosen to do sex work over being a shoe salesman or working in a restaurant and serving food. I just see that sex work is my choice. It is something that I make a lot of money at, or sometimes make small amounts of money, but it is enough money to support myself and to support my family and to help my granddaughter, and it also gives me the freedom to be able to do other things, which is my political career and the organizing of sex workers. I very much love my job. I love being a sex worker. I've done it all my life, and I just can't imagine that I would have chosen to be, you know, into another profession that had the same freedoms. I have traveled all over the world. I have met some of the most interesting people, and I'm very proud to be a sex worker. So I think that if you would start to, as we start to open our eyes and as sex workers begin to come out of the closet, we will see that we are your mothers, your daughters, your brothers, your sisters, your children, and we're good people.
And we're back. And I guess that clip, you there, Shaya?
Yes, I am.
And I guess that clip talks about, you know, that there's a poster project out in the East Coast. Are you familiar with that one?
Yep, the Nova Scotia campaign, Sex Workers Are People to Ad campaign, I think.
Yeah, and that's by Stepping Stone out in Halifax, which is another very positive activist agency working with sex workers. And their whole ad campaign is brilliant. I mean, my prostitute put me through school, and it's got a picture of a girl, and then in the bottom it says sex workers are mothers, and they have a whole line of these, and I find it a fascinating and fantastic campaign where it personalizes sex workers, because I think everybody has this viewpoint that sex workers fit into this very narrow, stereotypical role, and they're all women, and they all work in this particular movie, Hollywood kind of scenario, but that's not the way the industry is.
And that's not what we see, especially in London, in East London. That's not what we see at all.
No, that's not what we see at all, and I mean, my friends that are sex workers, they have kids, their grandmas, their grandpas, their brothers, they're not always victims, and they're not always persecuted, and sex work is a job just like any other job. Is that what you see there in your clinic as well?
I think it's really controversial because I feel that this campaign is trying to humanize mother, and I think that's important. I think everyone's a human, and I think that sometimes sex trade workers can be considered the people who've made bad choices. It's their fault they're in this profession. So I think they're trying to humanize people that, yeah, these are mothers, daughters, brothers. But again, it comes into that, you know, it's not a profession people we'd want to promote at this point, because it is something that is illegal. And even within their campaign, it was the controversy, the use of word, one of their sayings had in regards to tramp. So again, there was controversy surrounding that just using the word tramp again is causing more stigma. I mean, at our clinic, we treat everyone the same. We don't ask people's profession. If they divulge it, that's great. But everybody here is coming here for help. Everybody's here is coming to get tested and improve and maintain their health. That is our key component. Yes, we do at times, there is counseling needed. There is frustration. Some people have not chosen this profession. They, you know, I look at sex trade workers that it's on a continuum, right? You can have someone who is in that profession because they need money to go and get drugs to fuel an addiction, versus somebody who is maybe an escort or somebody who enjoys it. Or somebody who needs to do it, you know, they need the money for their children. So it can vary. So it's really hard for me to kind of pigeonhole these sex trade workers or this profession.
I think pigeonholing anybody in society is usually a bad idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As a whole. And yeah, this is a complicated issue, and that's why we wanted to talk about it on the air. I do have to ask our audience for forgiveness. I do have another guest that's on the phone, and our technical people are running around the station doing their best to get Chanel from Maggie's on the phone, and we will have her on live with us as soon as we possibly can. So until we can get that voice on the air, we're talking about sex work and this complex issue that surrounds sex work, and there's people that are new to this country that are brought and imported in for the exclusive use and exploitation. There's people on the total opposite end of the spectrum that are practicing sex work because it's a career and a career choice. So, I mean, there's a wide spectrum of people that are involved in the industry and a whole bunch of stuff that you know, and when we talk about the criminalization and the decriminalization of the industry, that's a huge issue when it comes to safety for people that are practicing in work within the industry.
Yeah, we were talking about that earlier, Michelle, is that It's you can put down on your income tax that you're a prostitute and you can claim your earnings, but it's illegal to do the act.
Not the act. The act is perfectly legal. But everything surrounding the act is not.
The communication part and trying to solicit people.
And if you, as a sex worker, if you have sex in your residence once with a client, you're fine. But the second time, then all of a sudden you fall prey of the body house laws. So what it does with sex workers, and I'm sure Chanel is going to talk much more professionally about this than I can, but is that sex workers are forced to go from place to place. They can't put anything in place to protect their safety and protect their security and keep themselves safe, because any of those provisions that they might put in to keep themselves safe while doing a legal act is not legal. And that's the fundamentals of the decriminalization case and the factors that are surrounding that. So we have another clip here for you, and
my new dog walker sends me photo slideshows of what my dog does in a day while I'm gone. I'm also a former sex worker.
I'm a New Yorker who cooks at home in her half-size kitchen, and I'm a sex worker.
I talk to my parents every day, and I'm a sex worker.
I'm a proper WASP, and I'm a sex worker.
I'm against the war in Iraq. I'm against the war in Afghanistan. I'm against the wars on sex workers, and I'm a former sex worker.
I'm a feminist, and I'm a former sex worker.
I have a cat named Fungi, and I am a sex worker.
I am a classically trained actress, a science fiction geek, and I am a sex worker.
I really, 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 really love bacon, and I'm a sex worker.
And we're back, and we do have Chanel now on the line. Are you there, Chanel? Hi, thank you for being so patient with us there.
Welcome, Chanel.
Hi there.
Welcome. Now, have you heard, I think you were in queue and you could actually hear the show there.
I actually only heard a bit of it because it was kind of coming and going, but I did hear a little bit. Who am I speaking with now?
This is Michelle.
Okay, great.
Okay.
And I'm Deb.
And Deb, my co-host, is here, and we have Shea on the line from the Middlesex London Health Unit.
Great.
Hi.
Hi there.
Can you tell us a little bit about yourself, Chanel?
So I work for a sex work organization called Maggie's in Toronto, and we're a sex work organization that is by and for sex workers, which is pretty unique in Canada. There's not many agencies that actually involve the leadership of sex workers in doing sex work organizing. So while we provide services to sex workers, we also are involved in building sex worker community and in sex worker activism in Toronto.
Wonderful. So you're the perspective that I really wanted to get on the show as well, because you work, you're an activist, you work mm-hmm. with sex workers on a regular basis, and I think Maggie's is internationally known for the work within the sex trade industry. So mm-hmm. thank you very much for coming online with us and talking about this issue. Now, we were talking about some of the complexities of sex workers. And I mean, one of the things that Shea brought up was around not promoting sex work as an industry due to the legalization. And I'm sure you have some comments around that.
What do you mean not promoting it? Like, who not promoting it?
Us as health or as health workers promoting it as an industry, because there's so many legalities around the issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I feel like sex work, though, is first of all an umbrella term that refers to more than just prostitution. And secondly, prostitution itself is legal in Canada, and there are ways to work legally. So it might be that there's, you know, a lot of caution, but I think some of that caution just comes from people's discomfort with sex work, and because there's so much fear and titillation around sex work more than the realities of the risks of the work that are very similar to other forms of work in some ways and are dissimilar because parts of it are criminalized. But, you know, prostitution itself is legal in Canada.
That it is. And I think that stigma is mm-hmm. is phenomenally huge.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I work within I'm an executive director of a community center here in London, and I work with social workers on a regular basis. And over the last few weeks when I've been talking about this show and what I was going to do, people that are extremely active and progressive people that are open-minded all of a sudden start getting squeamish.
Mm-hmm.
And that's this stigma that's attached to the industry.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, that stigma weighs in, I think, every single time we're having this conversation about sex work as a job.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Is that what you find with people that you're serving and the communities that you help? Do you find that fighting that stigma is a big part of your job?
It is. I mean, I think it really depends on where someone is located within the industry. I'm not sure if I heard correctly earlier, but I thought I heard one of you say something about how no one in there, when they're a teenager, thinks that they want to grow up to be a prostitute. I'm not sure if I heard that right, though.
Yes, that's right. I said that, yes.
Yeah. I think that's actually exactly what we're talking about when we say stigma. I find that quite offensive, because there are actually people who want to grow up to be sex workers. And I think on the one hand, and the second hand, I find it really classist to talk about choice only with regard to sex work. So the stigma comes up when we have those conversations about who chooses it, whether we choose it, putting sex workers who are more class privileged on the defensive. So they're saying things like, I choose it, I love it, I wouldn't want any other job. And that's great, but that creates this divide between more poor sex workers and more class privileged sex workers. And poor people don't choose their jobs, period. But it's only with regard to sex work that anybody notices capitalism, white supremacy, and patriarchy. So, you know, when we were 12-year-olds, I don't know about you, but I was doing completely poorly paid exploitative child care. And, you know, no one ever really was very concerned about whether I had a choice to do it because I was from a poor family. And it's only in regard to sex work that we ask those questions about choice. And it's what I call exceptionalism. Sex work is a job, it is work, and so it fits within the context of work just like everyone else. And so the more, the more class privilege someone has, the more they get to make decisions about what they want their work to look like, safety, having a lot of say over what clients they see and what clients they don't. the opportunity to travel. And it's true, sex work can bring all those things, and it is amazing. And for some people, their experience of sex work is similar to other forms of poorly paid work that suck. But I feel like that stigma is what frames the whole conversation about whether or not sex workers have a choice.
And if I could just interrupt you for a minute, Chantel, I'm glad that you feel this way, because I just had this argument with a feminist in London just recently, and my take on this is that women do have a choice what they do.
They do, but however, it's, again, to just say, like, it's not about, I actually don't want to, I think it's better for sex workers if we roll back this question of choice and say it's not appropriate to ask about choice with regard to sex work if we're not also asking about other forms of work. So, you know, does the Iranian refugee who arrives in Toronto and starts driving a cab have a choice? Of course, people with less privilege work within – they have fewer options. So, yes and no. He has some choice, but not as many. And that's – so there's nothing special about sex work. The point is that some people have more privilege, and if we want to make the – if we want to make the situation better for sex workers, it's about looking at the things that constrain sex workers' choices, and criminalization is definitely number one. But poverty, I mean, you know, criminalization and poverty – There are other things just other than just criminalization that make that constrain the choices that sex workers have.
And intersexed marginalities, where
you've
got racialized communities, and you've got all of this fits into the same as every industry.
Exactly, and that's why Maggie's believes in, for example, open borders, and because we know that immigration restrictions have a really negative impact on sex workers. And, you know, force them into parts of the industry that can potentially be exploitative.
And when we come back, we're going to have to go to some commercial breaks here. When we come back, maybe you can talk about some of the other aspects of other than prostitution, because I think that's what everybody focuses on when we have this conversation. So we'll be back after these short commercial breaks. Please hold on the line, Chantel. Now that I've got you, I want to keep you, okay?
Okay, no problem.
Thank you.
And we're back to Between the Margins on CHRW 94.9 FM. I'm Michelle Boyce.
I'm Deborah Hamza.
We have Shea on the line from the Middlesex London Health Unit, and we have Chantel from Maggie's in Toronto on the line. Thanks for holding with us, girls.
No problem. Hi there.
Wonderful. So maybe just before the break, we talked about different forms of sex work. And and so what options do people have when they want to get into the industry?
I guess it really depends on what they want out of the industry, whether they want to have, a lot of people are in the industry because they have kids, so they want to have a certain kind of flexibility where they get to make their own schedule. Some people want to have no contact, where they want to, you know, have something like they want to be in the sex industry, but they don't want to have to actually have like one-on-one personal contact with a client. So they might be interested in something like phone sex or webcamming, or porn, where, I mean, you know, they'd be having sexual contact with other people, but sometimes not. Sometimes you can just do solo work. Then of course there's stripping, there's escorting, street-based work. It also different countries have different parts of the industry. There's, I know, peep shows, and obviously there's dom work. There's working as a submissive. There's a whole, basically anything where you exchange some kind of erotic service for either money or some other form of compensation is sex work. So it's pretty broad.
So there's a lot of options out there. And there's a lot of different places, and it's not the Hollywood streetwalker that is the end-all of the industry.
Yeah, and in fact, in terms of prostitution, street-based work is 5, at most 10% of all prostitution that happens in Canada. So it's actually a lot more common for folks to be working indoors. I mean, it just makes a lot more sense to work indoors for most people, although there are reasons why people want to work on the street. So I think it's important for people to have that option. And there are places where sex work has been decriminalized, and then people have the option of working outdoors or indoors because some suit, working outdoors does suit some people better.
And some of those places that have decriminalized it have actually made it worse as well than what we have here, as I understand.
Decriminalization?
Yeah, certain aspects. Well, not decriminalization, but when you decriminalize it, then all of a sudden they put in licensing.
Oh, you mean legalization.
Legalization.
Yeah, no, those are very different things. So decriminalization has never made things worse for sex workers, but legalization can sometimes be really problematic. So there's an important difference between the two. Legalization is when basically the sex work goes from being underground to being completely controlled by the government. And of course that doesn't work for sex workers. And that means all kinds of restrictions. It can mean registries. Legalization is, for example, what the U.S. has in Nevada. And for some people that works. Because there's things about working in a legalized brothel that might appeal to them, but for most it wouldn't work because it means doing things like being registered, having your name and ID registered. Often it means lockdowns. It means control over whether the sex workers can leave the place of employment and go into the city. I mean, you know, these are the kinds of things that we actually hear all of these horror stories about trafficking. But in fact, legalization can sometimes have the just as bad restrictions on sex workers by the government, as decriminalization just takes it out of the criminal code, and then sex workers get to decide for themselves how they want to work. And mostly they want to work with other workers indoors with some form of security in place. And that's generally what happens when you decriminalize, is sex workers set up, you know, small businesses in, you know, quiet streets where they work together and see clients in their workplace.
In a safe environment that they can control their entranceways and their and their situation.
But you can actually do street work safely as well. So, for example, places that have decriminalized, street workers will have a safe house. I hate that word because they'll just basically have a little by-the-hour brothel right nearby where they can take clients and just for a small fee rent the room for an hour or a half hour to see their client.
Yeah, safe house just brings out a whole different construct of a picture. So
yeah, that's just what they call it. I know in Sydney, Australia, where I saw the street-based brothels.
And some of this legalization just brings police involvement.
Oh, that's absolutely what it does. Absolutely. So it just goes from under-the-table police attempts to control to explicit, legitimate, like where the state feels like they've got legitimate rights to police and control sex workers.
Yeah.
And then, of course, sex workers will always evade that, right? So then it just produces, the black market because, you know, the sex workers aren't going to go along with being, they want to work in the way they want to work and make their money and do it their own way. So then it produces another underground.
And the underground is what makes the lack of safety in a lot of cases.
It can. Yeah. I mean, the best thing is decriminalization where we, you know, sex workers just get to work in an industry like any other industry. Maybe they want to have a manager in a brothel. It's very handy because brothels do all of the work around, creating a space and advertising and all that stuff. Maybe they want to work for themselves and they get to decide.
Yeah. And there's a project that Emily Van Demeulen's working on that are you working on the recommendations project that she's working on as well?
It's the sex work policy group?
Yeah,
is that what you're talking about?
That group, yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm not.
Okay.
I'm familiar with the folks involved, but no, I'm not part of it. I'm really not a policy wonk.
Yeah, so that group is, they're actually, when it comes to decriminalization, they're trying to put in place policies that are not going to stigmatize sex workers even more after decriminalization.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a really positive step for the
industry.
It is,
yeah, and that's sex workers trying to take control over their working conditions. So because the state, you know, municipally, provincially, and federally will always try to control sex workers they will always fail, but they will certainly do everything they can to try to control sex workers. So I'm really glad that group is happening, because what they're trying to do is there's going to be a vacuum, you know, if the old laws are thrown out, and then municipalities and the federal government will try to rush in with some set of rules which have no relationship to what sex workers need. So it makes sense for a group to start to develop some recommendations around what it actually should look like and what works best for sex workers. And we know from other international examples of what works best.
And we know so often, we've got so many different examples of where laws have been struck down. And, I mean, even same-sex marriage was one of those, relisting SRS for the trans populations, where they create these vacuums. And then...
Yeah.
And then policies are put into place, rush ad hoc policies
that are terrible.
Yeah, they're horrible. And but you know, that's the way politicians work. You know, we've see a need, fill a need, whether we're qualified to do so or not.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
So
and then no one is more qualified to talk about what sex workers need than sex workers, right?
And I'm 100% behind you on that.
And
so many times that public consultation is absent. I mean, we see that with the male sexual assault case and, you know, Chris Bentley and all of the, you know, problems that they ran into there by not involving that group within policy. And, and you know, the best ideas always involve those involved in the policy piece.
Yeah, those directly impacted by the policy.
But that's what our government does over and over again. They don't consult with the specific people involved in different areas.
Yeah.
So we have a clip from Emily, actually, and she gives us the 5 recommendations to make the world a wonderful place. And we've got that now.
I can tell you where sex workers and where my research has really shown where it's important to go. So I would argue that there's sort of 5 main changes that need to really happen in order to change the situation. And none of which are easy, none of which are necessarily overnight kinds of changes that should happen. And yet at the same time, these are really necessary. So what I would say, I can tell you what I would suggest. So the first thing is that prostitution and sex work really needs to be seen as a form of labor. I mean, it's a particular form of labor. It's a form of sexual labor, but it is a form of labor nonetheless. And the sex workers' rights movement has been arguing this for well over 3 decades internationally and in Canada for that same amount of time. Even at Maggie's here in Toronto, for example, the sex work discussion and political organizing group is called the Real Work Group, right? To be able to really signify that it is real work. It's not just some kind of victimization and exploitation. That certainly does exist, as it does in every other area of work. But it is a form of work nonetheless. Sex workers need to be included in policymaking. And so this is the second sort of area that really needs to change. And it's something that we've been working on here locally with the Sex Work Policy Group, is to make sure that sex workers' voices, their experiences, and their perspectives are seen as not only as legitimate forms of knowledge, but as expert knowledges, that it is sex workers who have the most knowledge when it comes to the effects of policy on their lives and on their work and on their families. And so they need to be consulted when it comes to any kind of policy change or recommendation going forward. So that's really, really important. Third, I would say what we've just been talking about, decriminalization. So it's all great and well to see sex as a form of work and to include sex workers in policy, but unless the situation is decriminalized and unless there are no more prostitution-related offenses in the criminal code, we're not going to get very far, because we can see how the criminal code really creates the situation of vulnerability and violence against sex workers. And the Justice Himmel's recent decision at the Ontario Superior Court around the charter challenge of the sex work-related sections was phenomenal. It was just amazing to see how she, too, very much identified the criminal code in and of itself creating the situation of harm that sex workers are working under. So that needs to change. Decriminalization needs to happen. There needs to be sex worker-influenced workplace standards and occupational health and safety and other kinds of labor rights and protections within individual workplaces, so that sex workers can actually have access to labor protections and like a labor relations board like other workers in Ontario workplaces have access to. Right now, sex workers don't, primarily because those workplaces are criminalized, but also because there's a fear that if a sex worker ends up, say, going to some kind of employment standards and making a complaint against their workplace, well, not only are the police then going to get involved and do a, surveil that workplace and see what's happening on the inside, but it's possible that both the workplace will get shut down and that sex worker herself might end up getting charged, right? So right now, the kinds of standards and labor conditions within workplaces are often not very good because there aren't these kinds of protections that sex workers have access to. And then the last thing that needs to change is that formal labor, like unions and associations and other kinds of labor organizing groups and associations need to really get on board and support sex workers in the struggle for these basic labor rights and protections. So, of course, as we know, sex worker unionization is not new. It's been happening internationally. It's been happening in Canada. There are sex worker unions. Like, for example, the International Union of Sex Workers in Great Britain is actually part of Great Britain's largest trade labor organization. The Lusty Lady is an example of a peep show in the United States that is part of, and I think that they're still part of the AFL-CIO. So all of these things are really important. And we need to make sure that this continues to happen in Canada. Formal labor and organizations like QP and other unions get on board and actually start to support labor organizing, official and formal labor organizing. So that's what I would say, based on my research, based on my political activism with sex workers and based on what the sex workers' rights movement internationally and in Canada have been calling for. I'd say those would be the five main things that really need to change in order for the situation to improve.
And we're back. So, Shayla, how does that fit within, the mandates of the Middlesex London Health Unit?
Well, we're not as involved as for example, Maggie's in Toronto or some of these other groups. I mean, what we do is we work within what we can, right? So we just, we look at public health as our role as for these clients is reducing harm. So, I mean, I guess that would fall in some of it is that, they don't have very many people they can go to if there is an issue of harm concern. But we look at reducing harm in a health perspective. So if they are involved in using drugs, for example, how do we reduce that harm? Because they may not want to stop. So, again, we offer needles. If they are involved in this work, then how do we reduce their harm being exposed to sexually transmitted infections? How do we expose if the condom breaks and they're worried about being pregnant, they can come in for the morning after pill. So that is largely our focus here in the clinic. And when we do have a nurse that does go to the Elgin Middlesex Detention Center, and by saying that, I'm not saying that sex trade workers are all in jail. It's just that's a mode of contact for us. So when a nurse does go out there, again, it's what they need. If they just feel like talking about, that they're not leaving the profession, how can we help them manage their lifestyle in a healthful way in their profession? So that's really our large focus.
Wonderful. How about you, Chanel?
Can you repeat the question?
Oh, I'm just, what do you think of the five solutions that Emily?
I'm definitely on board. I think Emily and I and Maggie share a lot of overlap in our political perspectives. I think the one thing I would say is that I think that nothing else will fall into place as it should without sex worker leadership. So I think that was one of the points she mentioned, and I feel like it probably needs to be the first one, just in terms of developing all of the solutions and strategies that come from that, that we need to start there.
I think you're absolutely right. And I mean, from a radio host perspective, I can tell you that I have some of the issues that I deal with through the years with around human rights. Some shows are more difficult to get people to talk about the issues than others. I mean, for example, when I was doing the LGBT parenting show, it was very, very difficult to get lesbian, gay, bi, trans parents to come on and talk about being parents.
Really?
The stigma attached to that made it extremely difficult to get people on, and I had many people decline that invitation. This is one of those shows, and I will put it back on, my fellow media people that I would honestly say shame.
Yeah, this is London is like a conservative town here.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I would say shame on my media cohorts in their reporting about the industry. And I'm sure that creates that increases the stigma, that increases the public piece where you know those leaders can't come forward.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And I think we really, I mean, in my own personal opinion, we really need to start looking at sex work completely different as a society. I don't know how, besides having shows like this where we show that there's an industry out there and it's not the stereotypical industry. And sometimes it is, because stereotypes are based on some reality. They always are.
Mm-hmm.
But there's always so much more to the story than just that stereotype.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
I think talking about it is the best thing that we can do.
There needs to be more talking about it, especially in London.
Especially in London, where it's extremely closed-minded. This issue, I mean, I can't tell you how many. I was sitting in my daughter's hockey rink. I had actually interviewed Emily from my car out front of the hockey rink because my daughter was about to go on the ice because she could only spare a couple of minutes for me. And thank you very much, Emily, for sparing that time. And then I came in and I was talking to some of the other parents about, you know, where did you go? And, I was talking about sex work and doing an interview on the radio. And you know, 15 people in each direction go, You know, until we change.
And all of them have actually consumed sex work. If you've ever looked at porn, you've been a client.
That's right.
Yeah, and and there's so many other aspects of sex work besides money.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know too many of my girlfriends that have decided to go out for a date because they wanted a nice meal, not because they like the person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's basically sex work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, it is. It's trading, any kind of trade. But yeah, there's just so much stigma around it that people have a hard time seeing themselves as people who might have something in common, like not only something in common around the fact that they provide some kind of sexual service or a trade sometimes, but also just something in common as workers, you know, who have clients they like more than others, who have bosses they like more than others, who, you know, wish they had paid vacation time, who worry about, you know, an injury to their body affecting their ability to work. Obviously, there are a lot of things that are different about sex work because of the stigma, like a lot of people are closeted to their family or their kids about what they do. But there's a lot that is similar, you know. We're workers, and there is a lot of overlap.
There is. And is there anything else you'd like to add while you've got listeners there, Chanel?
I feel like we've covered a lot of ground today. I want to thank both of you for doing this show today and for giving folks the chance to have a more reasoned conversation about sex work that isn't full of the hysteria that normally surrounds it.
Well, thank you both for coming on. It's been a pleasure. We could probably do a 4 or 5 hour show on this and not even scratch the surface. But like with all of our shows, we come to a close. And I'm Michelle Boyce.
And I'm Devil Hamza.
And this is Between the Margins on CHRW 94.9 FM, a show about people's pursuit of happily ever after. If you wanted to hear more shows from us, our website is www.betweenthemargins.ca, where you can hear the podcast of this show and many others online. So everybody out there, happy Valentine's Day.
Happy Valentine's Day.
You know, hug a sex worker today. It's a good day to do that. So have a healthy day, everyone, and thank you very much.
Yes, thank you very much.